Don't be frightened, little granddad. Come on. There, all for you.
I don't know why they never made another Spike series. Maybe that the BBC had decided that Spike had had a long run of material and he just needed to be rested while they gave someone else the opportunity to do it. I don't really know. You'd have to ask the executives. But it was rather sad that we never did another show.
If you see Pod, tell him. Two Pod, four children. Oh, hello. You find me trying to come up with a suitably punning title for this week's edition of Goon Pod. My guest is the comedy writer, Andrew Marshall. Regular listeners will recall that in February I spoke to Andrew's erstwhile writing partner, David Renwick. Both had written for Spike Milligan in the 80s. In fact, they became very good friends with Spike and would socialise with him over the years. So, obviously, I was keen to talk to Andrew about his memories of Spike, as well as talk about his career in general. Later in the conversation, we touch on Alexei Sayle's stuff, 2.4 children, health and efficiency, Wilt, and also Douglas Adams and John Lloyd. Something for everyone. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Oh, and by the way, I think I'm going to go with Whoops Apocalypse. How does that sound? Sodger then.
I've never been that interested in myself as a person, I guess. It's just, it's the work that motivates me, you know, not the, it's probably an absolute curse these days because I probably ought to be far more self-promoting, but it's just not in me. I'm not that kind of person for some reason. I'm a quiet sort of person, you know?
Good. So am I.
Do you think, I nearly said Prince. Do you think King Charles listens to it?
Well, I have...
I'm still waiting for my knighthood.
Before the Queen died, I thought, wouldn't it be a great coup to get Prince Charles on?
Yeah.
I mean, how the hell do you make contact and all that? Wouldn't it be great? And then he became king and, you know, he's got no time now.
No.
So that ain't going to happen. I have tried to broaden it out so it's not just about the goons as such. I like to talk about comedy in general of a certain vintage right up to the 90s, I suppose, we tend to talk...
When it stopped being funny, basically.
Yeah, yeah. From 1999 onwards.
Yeah, that would be exactly the point, I would...
When did 2.4 children end?
1999.
There you go. I encourage talk, you know, general conversation about comedy in general and all that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And so thank you very much for coming on, because I appreciate... You didn't really do a lot of work with Spike Milligan, but I'd just like to talk about your influences and the work you did do with him. And I know that, because obviously I've had David on previously, and, you know, he did talk quite a bit about there's a lot of it about, and the sort of the fact that the two of you didn't get a lot. You wrote a lot, but a lot of it wasn't used, I believe.
I think that's often the case, though, in when, you know, when we were contributing sketches to shows, quite often you'd write a lot of... I think we did write, at one point, some Morgan and Wise sketches, and not a single one was ever used.
Right.
I think at one point, at the very early stage, it was going to be called Q10, because there was talk about a sort of hen with false eyelashes on that was the cute hen or some such thing. But it eventually... I don't know who gave it the title as a laudabout. I don't think it was Spike. It's probably the BBC management or something. But it really has got to have a sensible title this year. I don't have all this cue nonsense.
It only took them 13 years to decide on that. Yeah, there's a lot of it about was the sort of the last knockings of Spike's TV sketch career, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes, I think we managed to kill it off pretty adequately.
And so... Scrolling right back, because I guess you were just a bit too young for the Goon Show.
My first, well, in a way, I mean, my first encounter would be with the Telegoons, which I think came out when I was around 10 or something like that.
Well, they've literally just last week celebrated the 60th anniversary, so it was October 63.
So I would have been 9 and even younger.
Yeah.
And I absolutely loved that. And in fact, I only recall this the other day. I totally forgot about it. My mother made me an Eccles sort of doll.
Oh, right.
I wish I still had it. It was a very, very good rendition of the one on the Telegoons. Then later, I think when I was around 11-ish, they repeated a selection of Goon shows on what was then the home service.
Hmm.
And I remember listening to them with my dad, who was an enormous fan of the Goon Show. You know, it was very much his kind of humour. And I was talking to Rob Grant, my current writing partner, today, and he said his dad was an enormous fan of the Goon Show. I don't know whether that's significant or not. But we listened to them together. You know, I think they were quite late at night as well. I think I was allowed to stay up. You know, they were very, very funny. And we had, in our house, we had two or three of the Goon LPs. Mm. The BBC had filleted the music out of the shows. You probably know this already. Everybody does who's listening to this. And condensed them down to just the dialogue. And I think we had, three of them. So there were certain episodes that I'd heard like 600 times because...
Yeah.
In those days, you had about 12 records, and you just used to play them over and over and over again.
So that would be Tales of Old Dartmoor, probably. The Scarlet Capsule, probably.
Yeah, Tales of Old Dartmoor, yes. And I think China's Story was
there. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, I could be wrong in this. I'm not quite sure. Didn't Jack Jackson use bits of them on his show? He was very, very skillful and interesting, a sort of precursor to Kenny Everett, in a way. And he would use bits of comedy records and sort of interact with them by clever tape editing.
Later, taken up by Adrian Just.
Yes, and Victor Lewis Smith, I suppose.
Yeah.
That's the lineage of all that. But my dad was also an enormous fan of Jack Jackson The BBC only hold two Jack Jackson shows in their archives, which, when my father was very, very ailing, they very kindly gave me the two episodes that they've got so I could play them.
Ah,
really sweet.
Just on that, you say they only hold two, but things are turning up all the time that were thought lost. Just this week, and I had no intention of mentioning this today, but you've just made me think of it. Are you aware of the fact that in the mid-50s on Hancock's Half Hour, Tony Hancock did a runner?
Yes.
And for three episodes, or two episodes...
With Harry Secombe.
Harry Secombe. And then there was a third episode when Hancock returned and Harry came back and there was it gave Hancock an opportunity via the show to thank Harry.
Yes. And that's right.
That's just turned up, which is brilliant news. So really looking forward to hearing that when it's all restored.
I mean, I've got a lot of old reel-to-reel tapes of radio shows I recorded when I was quite young. But unfortunately, I haven't got a reel-to-reel tape recorder that works anymore. So we'll never be able to retrieve those tapes, unfortunately. But just sort of bringing us back to the subject again.
Sorry, yes.
I think I'm right in saying the first joke I ever sold to TV was on the Harry Secombe Show. It wasn't a very good joke. It was simply someone saying, and now the long-range weather forecast, and it cut to a picture of Harry Secombe standing a very long way away shouting, rain.
That's funny.
Still relatively funny. And not bad for about, I must have been about 13 or something when I said
that. Oh, wow. So, okay, right. So if you were born in the mid-50s, you'd have been... the right age for Flying Circus, perfect age for Flying Circus, which is, and obviously, I guess, sorry, I'll read that again bit earlier. Was that all an influence as well on you?
Oh, yes. We used to listen to, I mean, on Sunday in the 60s, when I was sort of, you know, a young, you know, middle child of about 10 or something, there was never any television. Television wasn't on during the day.
Mm.
And every Sunday lunchtime, there would be a comedy show. It would very often be Round the Horn or the Clitheroe Kid or something like that. And we used to, you know, as a family, we would always listen to those. And, you know, they were an enormous motive for me starting to write comedy, which I think I'm right in saying I started about 11 sending things to TV and radio. And eventually I used to sell kind of like little what we used to call quickies.
Yeah.
To TV.
Weekending?
And later, no, weekending came much later when I was 18, I came to London to train to teach maths at Borough Road College in Hounslow. And then I was free to cut lectures on a Friday and go into weekending and write weekendings.
Right. Okay.
But previous to that, when I was at home in Lowestoft, I'd written jokes and quickies for the precursor to That's Life, which was called Braden's Week.
Yep.
And I used to send those in weekly, and they would very often be done. I was actually, you know, writing comedy at a very, very early age. So I've been doing it. I reckon I've been doing it for something like 57 years. I think I calculated the other day. Actually selling it, you know.
And making decent money or just...
Yeah, you used to make a reasonable amount of money. In fact, I at one point just hopping on to weekending, I wrote so many next week's news lines that they had to make me editor at the end because they were just spending too much money on me.
But so when you were 11, 12, 13 and you were writing comedy,
yeah,
what did your friends at school think of this? Were you getting them to act it out? Were you putting on plays? Were you doing anything like that?
No, I never did anything like that. Mm-hmm. I don't know that they even knew, to be honest. I mean, they might have known. I don't really recall terribly. It was a very long time ago. Yeah. I was a very young a boy at the time. So I think my parents thought I was a bit strange, really. But, you know, you have to remember at that time, there was really no way of getting into comedy other than being a writer. You weren't really allowed to perform your comedy because acting was a closed shop.
Mm.
You weren't allowed to direct your comedy because TV was a closed shop. And for someone, you know, my dad was a bricklayer and my mum worked in Marks and Spencer's. And for someone with my background, you know, who hadn't gone to Oxbridge, there were very few ways into, you know, one's chosen profession. It was quite a difficult, you know, way to find a door into it.
Did you harbour any ambitions though to be in front of the camera or the microphone, or did you always think, well, I just want to be a writer?
I think I wanted to be John Cleese, you know, around that age.
Okay,
but it's just that, you know, it wasn't technically possible. I mean, it's taken me, you know, 60 years to actually be a performer and perform my own sketches, which we did a couple of years ago in the Nether regions, you know, and
yeah.
I have to say, it was such a joyous experience to finally get to that point.
You popped up in Alexis Sayle's stuff, haven't you?
Yeah, and I was briefly in David's drama series. What was it called?
Love Soup.
Love Soup, yeah.
Mm.
I suppose if we're really desperate...
Which I think we know we are.
We could always wheel out this party piece.
What's this?
Robbie Todd, the actor who plays Moose, has the ability to hold a belch for 35 seconds on the spot.
Tragically, we'll get a bigger laugh on anything we could ever write.
Okay, all right, okay. Listen. So she'll just stand there staring at him, and she waits for him to finish, and what does she say? She says...
God, you are unbelievable.
I didn't know you were an atheist.
Yes. Enough with your atheist remarks.
Which, as a Quaker, I find very offensive.
As a practicing Quaker,
I find most offensive.
Yeah, you don't think the religious heterodoxy might be a little taxing for her?
Oh, what's an atheist?
It's a Quaker. Is that like a posh duck?
Maybe.
When I've been teaching for about a year and, I think a year and a term, I was given the opportunity to go to London Weekend Television as a sort of trainee writer under Humphrey Barclay in the comedy department, which I took like a shot. And then, you know, that set me up for a future in comedy writing. You know, it was a great job because you could just hang around and watch things happening and contribute to this, that, and the other. And we you know, we were making End of Part One at the time, so that sort of paid them back a certain amount, and it was a great apprenticeship, really.
You can tell it sprang from Python's loins in many ways, I suppose. There's a lot of TV parodies, and I gather that the first series, there was kind of a what would you call it, a connecting thread,
yes,
with two very bland characters around whom the comedy happened.
Yes, Norman and Vera Straight Man, they were called.
That's right. And I can remember, and we're probably talking 3 or 4 years ago, watching some episodes of End of Part One, and there's so much commentary about television and television shows and the television industry. Mm. There's a sketch where I think it's Denise Coffey is auditioning to be the test card girl,
yes,
for example.
Yes. We had a terrible problem with that, actually, because Denise was sitting there, you know, with the clown and the blackboard.
Yeah.
And the gag was that she, you know, that was her job, just to sit there still all the time whilst various orchestra played. And we had the director's voiceover saying, okay, fade down orchestra one and fade up orchestra two. And because of the musicians' union rules, we weren't allowed to say this because you actually literally had to have two orchestras and pay them.
Oh, jeez.
just talking about the closed shop again. So I think it actually had to say track one and track two in the end. But there were all sorts of rather bizarre sort of Spanish practices like that we had to contend with, which were extraordinary at the time.
So, yeah, I know there was like TV parodies, was a Call My Bluff parody, which I very much enjoyed. But there was also things like conceits like the closing titles coming in halfway through the show and things like that. That is very Python, I think. Yeah. Was there a lot of Spike in terms of the Q series that went into that?
Yes, Spike. Yes, of course. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, sketches that didn't end and molded into other sketches and all sorts of things like that. Yes.
Yeah, and that was kind. End of Part One was kind of an unofficial spin-off or television spin-off of the Berkus Way.
Yes,
and I know that Spike was quite impressed by both. And look, I don't want to keep going back to when I spoke to David, but it's just that he spoke about how your introduction to Spike came about, and he invited you out for dinner, mm-hmm. I believe, in London, like an Italian restaurant, and he said that it was equal parts hilarious and baffling.
David has the advantage of his diaries to look back on. I don't recall that at all, but
okay,
no recollection. Well, we did go out. Spike would quite often take us out for meals in Hendon to the Indian restaurant, but I don't remember. There probably was such a thing. I just don't recall it at all.
Okay, and do you remember much about the actual, you know, working on? There's a lot of it about.
Oh, yes. It was just a great... I mean, Spike was... You know, I really love Spike. He was a lovely man. He reminded me enormously of my father. So it's kind of like having a comedy father in a way. He was very, very nice to us. He used to invite us to his house where we'd have these meetings and read through the things with Neil Shand.
Mm.
He was just... a very warm and wonderful host. I mean, he was Spike Milligan, so there was a lot of inconsistency in his character. But we had some really great evenings there. And, you know, I remember them very fondly. So, who knows why he chose some sketches about others. I remember one interesting sketch we did, which was a sort of a fake Spike obituary that started one of the shows, which claimed Spike had just died. Yeah. I think this came out of Spike Milligan saying to us once, that tone they use when someone's died, they always cut back to the studio and the newsreader says, Spike Milligan, who died today. I can just hear them saying, Spike Milligan, who died today. And it sort of, you know, we wrote that little bit where it looks as if he died, and then the still picture of him came to life and started taking its own pulse and things. I was amused to find in a later Spike biography, it was actually published at the beginning of the book as if it were a Spike written sketch. Which he didn't write any of it at all. It was actually David Ray.
But I remember that sketch, and they paid tribute to Spike's.
Yeah.
Did they pay tribute to Spike by screening a bloody awful George Formby film?
he was a great person to work with, and fascinating as a character. You know, he would have on his mantelpiece a sort of notice that said, "We do not smoke cancerettes in this house," and he would stand in front of it smoking a cigar. You know, that's the kind of person he was.
Do you know? Do you remember when you were there at Spike's house one night when he went off to get something and he came back in looking very shaken because he'd just had a phone call to say Diana Dawes had died?
Yes, I remember that distinctly. The thing about visiting Spike was you go, I expect David has already said this, but you go round to his house and ring the bell, and this sort of really sad old man would open the door and say, "Hello, Andrew, come in." And you know, he'd be really, really down. And during the course of the evening, he'd sort of, like an inflating balloon, would actually gradually become Spike Milligan, become quite funny and fun and so forth. You know, would give you funny hats to put on or some such thing, or would show you his Indian family albums and all sorts of things that were enormous fun. Yeah, I remember that very distinctly. And when he came back, that was the end of the evening, because he was very, very... I don't know why he was so upset about that, but maybe Diana Dawes was a friend. I don't really know. She was a great... she was a very nice woman, Diana Dawes. We did a Bruce Forsyth sketch with her once on Bruce Forsyth's Big Night. I always remember this because it was sort of like, you know, where, you know, he used to get the public to come in and play a sort of play. And Bruce Forsyth was playing Fagin in it, and somebody had to play Nancy. We went through this whole list of people, and we eventually the only person we could think of was Diana Dawe. And she came in to read, and Bruce was late into rehearsals. And so I had to sit there reading through the script with Diana as Bruce Forsyth, like, "Diana, my love, Nancy." And the funny thing is, knowing Bruce Forsyth is going to sort of come into the room at some point, go, which he did. And I have to give him credit. He didn't bat an eyelid. He just came down, sat down, and immediately just took over the script from the point I was there.
Brilliant. I hear he was a very nice man.
He was an extremely nice man, a great person to work with. He was very, very good to everybody on the team. You know, however lowly they were, he was absolutely a real, really kind and not that he wasn't, you know, fussy about detail, which all good comedians are. You know, they check their props and they check their lines, and they need people to back them up and get everything right. And he would get a little bit chippy sometimes if someone was a bit incompetent. But generally speaking, he was an extraordinarily nice man to work with, yes.
Yeah. David said, because I contacted him about something else recently, and I mentioned that I was going to be talking to you. It was probably a while back anyway. And he said, ask him if he can remember the cupboard full of vests.
Yes.
I can. So I have no idea what that means.
Well, the previous producer of the Milligan series, who I won't name because he was also a nice man, Spike described. Do you know whatever his name was? He he's a cupboard full of vests. That's what he is. That was his description of the previous.
Right.
I won't say his name, but you know, because it's not. But you could look it up.
Yes.
Good evening. Here is the news. A Unemployment reaches new heights. Today, two unemployed men in a helicopter reached a height of 6,000 feet. In the High Court today, a judge fell off.
Here, stop that. What do you think you're doing?
The autocue's gone wrong, Julian.
Oh, gosh. We'll have to go to emergency.
News that Spike Milagner is returning to the BBC TV has brought the desired reaction from Supremo Alastair Mill. He is to commit suicide in lieu of a golden handshake. He is to get a silver kick up the ass.
The thing that I was musing about the other day about the goons was, you know, we're always told, history relates, that after the Second World War, there was a feeling of, you know, we're all in it together and we'll all, you know, cooperate and across the classes and things, and it'll all be wonderful, and we'll found the National Health Service and so on and so forth. But the Goon Show actually tells you a very different thing, doesn't it? It tells you that the officer classes are not to be trusted,
which is
an entirely different sort of angle. So maybe that post-war consensus wasn't quite as, you know, people describe, I wonder.
No, it's a very good point, and that's why so many in BBC management at the time were so against the Goons, because they were, you know, they were officer class themselves. They'd been, you know, they took it personally, you know, the caricatures like Bloodnock and the like.
Yeah, you get a more detailed and nuanced version of it in Spike's War Diaries books.
Yes.
You know, the war was a very different experience to, you know, watching a war, you know, a war movie that they made after the war about the Dam Busters or something.
Yeah,
real war was an entirely different thing, you know. It was, and I don't actually, and I think this is where, you know, I think Spike was a very interesting man, because he was a leader in so many ways, you know, over the environment and over all kinds of things. And, you know, just writing the truth about how it is to be in a war, you know, as a person, was really interesting. That, you know, and, okay, it was cloaked in comedy, but what it was telling you was kind of disturbing, wasn't it? You know, there was a window into the actual realities of the war that I think very few, even serious books had done up to that point.
Yeah, and funny enough, David told me that when he and you had been at Spike's, or been out for a meal, or one occasion when you were in Spike's company,
yes,
he told you that he'd only just found out from one of his army friends that he hadn't appreciated the depiction of him in the books.
I can't remember what the name of the guy was, though.
I'm assuming it was Harry Edgington.
Harry Edgington, that's it, right. Yeah. Gunnar Edgington says, I'd heard from Gunnar Edgington. He hated what he did in the books. And I said, yes, but what about the other people? And we're kind of expecting a hilarious end of this story. And he said, oh, they hated it too. They all hate you.
But they left it years to tell him that.
Yeah, that's just funny. I don't know why. It's funny because it was Spike saying it. It's looking terribly crestfallen. I don't know whether Spike thought, you know, whether they would find it a kind of interesting tribute or whether it would irritate them.
Well, the thing is, on this show recently, we covered the first memoir, which was Adolf Hitler, My Partner's Downfall, which required rereading it, of course. And Harry Edgington comes out of it very well. You know, he's trading jokes with Spike. You know, in fact, in some cases, he's outdoing Spike on the humour front. If, you know, it's Spike writing it, of course, and it's a lot of it is obviously, well, how much of what Spike writes in that memoir or any of the memoirs is actual remembered dialogue? You know, it's
very little of it, I should
very
think.
Very little, but still. But,
you know, what you recall and what you remember are different things, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. But no, he comes out of it very well, I felt. But I haven't reread the others for many years, so perhaps perhaps he writes him less sympathetically as the books go on.
Possibly. I mean, I don't know, really. I just think it's a very funny anecdote what Spike said that day. And I suppose we were probably rather cruel to laugh at him, but it just was very funny. The fact that it looked like, you know, it was one of those stories that looked like it was going to end with, but everyone else was hilarious, but it didn't end like that at all. I don't know, really. So we dealt with Spike quite a lot. Harry, I only peripherally knew, and Sellers, I didn't know at all. But of course, you know, he's got a fantastic body of work to look back on.
I'm doing a best of listeners' top 20 Sellers films for the end of the year. By the way, do you have a particular favourite?
Well, you know, I'm never sure about these lists because I don't. I mean, how can you compare Chance the Gardener with, I don't know, Inspector Clouseau? They're just entirely different levels of,
characterization,
aren't they? I mean, even in Doctor Strangelove, you can't compare Strangelove with President Muffley, can you?
No, you can't.
Again, they're totally different sort of angles of... So I don't know, a favorite. It's so hard. What criteria are you using to judge?
Well, my criteria would be I can easily say my favorite Sellers film is the one that I would put on comfort viewing, one that I consistently enjoy from beginning to end, which is A Shot in the Dark, which was the second Clouseau film. I just wondered if you had a particular, if there was one film above all others that of his that stood out to you.
Well, a Clouseau movie is best enjoyed in the cinema. I can remember going to see The Return of the Pink Panther and just being in a room, you know, a big cinema full of people just laughing and laughing and laughing at all these things. That's a great experience. On the other hand, Dr. Strangelove is a very chilling piece of work. It has great significance. Being there is a fabulous end to a career. I know it isn't strictly the end because there's Fu Manchu.
Yeah.
I mean, even I have to say, even Fu Manchu has fun in it. You know, it's not a terrible, it's not a completely terrible movie.
It's not his worst film.
No, not by any means. I remember seeing with my dad The Wrong Arm of the Law and Two Way Stretch and a double bill once. They're a great pair of movies, you know.
Yeah.
Very enjoyable, but not a huge amount of depth in the characterizations, really. There are so many. I mean, even Sellers in Casino Royale is interesting. You know, it's a kind of interesting sort of take on James Bond. I mean, he's so difficult to pin down in any one thing, isn't it?
He's
very good in Tom Thumb, for example. the fatter Sellers together with Terry Thomas.
Yeah, have you seen The Optimists of Nine Elms?
Yes, I saw it when it came out. It's, I believe they didn't they want Buster Keaton to do that?
Yeah, they did.
Wouldn't that have been fantastic if he had? That's just such a regret to me. I don't know whether he was too ill while that started.
No, I think because we covered that film last week, by the way, because it was his 50th anniversary.
Right.
It's a great film, but no, I think they wanted in the end because it was originally in development hell, that film. If they called it that back in the day, but you know, it took about best part of 10 years to get it on screen. And originally, they had Buster Keaton in mind, and then the studios or whoever the money men were, they didn't think he was bankable. And there was a few other people considered, and in the end, Sellers took it up, and Sellers does it very well. And I said on the show that we did on it last week that I think The Optimists of Nine Elms would have been a better, you know, instead of Fu Manchu, a better final film, because it would have, coming after Being There, I think it would have capped his career quite nicely.
He was apparently doing a rendition of his father, wasn't he?
Yes, he was, yeah.
Very interesting. I wonder what it would have been like if he'd played Fagin and Oliver. I wonder if he would have been better than Ron Moody or not. It's a good, you know, there is what if, something like that.
Well, there's so many films that he turned down that he probably shouldn't have, and films that he took on that he shouldn't have, you know.
I think that's inevitable when you're an actor. There's always, you know, the ones you wished you'd done, the ones you wished you hadn't done. I mean, Michael Caine had a very good, has a very good attitude, doesn't it? In order to make, you know, 4 good movies, you've got to make 20 movies. That's why I always make lots of movies.
And that's a house for my mum. That Jaws the Revenge, or whatever it was, that bought my mum a new house. Yeah. No, but I think Sellers' biggest regret, in terms of the film that he regrets turning down, was The Producers.
It's so hard when someone... Well, I didn't think anyone else could play Max Bialystock, but Nathan Lane plays him perfectly well, so I don't know. Who knows?
Nathan Lane, have you seen The Birdcage?
Yes.
Isn't that... I don't know what you think of The Birdcage as a film, but Nathan Lane in that is... Oh, one of my favourite performances ever in a film.
That's all I am to you, isn't it? A meal ticket. Never mind about my feelings. Never mind about my suffering. It's just about your show. Not even our show. Your show. Well, I want a palimony agreement. And I want one now.
Well, I don't have a palimony agreement on me right now. Is tomorrow all right?
Don't use that tone to me.
What tone?
That sarcastic, contemptuous tone that means you know everything because you're a man and I know nothing because I'm a woman.
You're not a woman.
Oh, you bastard.
Everybody take it easy.
Whatever I am, he made me. I was adorable once, young and full of hope. Now, look at me. I'm this short, fat, insecure, middle-aged thing.
I made you short?
Am I right in thinking it's an Elaine May and Mike Nichols?
Yeah, it is.
Probably their last collaboration, isn't it?
Probably. It would have been, yeah.
Well, I mean, well, you've got Masters in charge there, haven't you? So what more can you say?
No,
it's a very good piece of work. I think the musical had happened by then, hadn't it? So it was kind of a surprise. Mm. Mm. I suppose whoever the movie was, it United Artists, I don't know, probably controlled the rights to the original French movies, but not the musical. Thought, oh, the musical's doing well. Let's bring out the non-musical English.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. No, I have to say, Nathan Lane. I went to see him and the Producers in the West End. I don't know if you saw that.
No,
but you. There are certain people when you see them just radiate a kind of a comedy nuclear energy. You cannot describe it as a sort of comedy charisma. Nathan Lane just has it, whatever it is. When you're in that theatre, my God, you're aware. I tell you what it reminds me of. I was once on holiday in Boston, and we went out to see if we could, in a boat, you know, on an organised trip, see if we could find a whale and whale watching.
Hmm.
And we sailed off for about an hour, and then suddenly you had this terrible feeling that something huge was nearby. You couldn't see it. There was, you know, no water flumes or anything, but you
there was a presence.
There was a presence of this huge object, and not long after that, we saw the whale. And that's the kind of feeling that I got when I saw Nathan Lane in The Producers.
Wow.
The presence of this huge object. And, you know, it's a rare quality. It only happens with a few people.
Well, I'm enjoying him right now, actually. I'm watching and working my way through the second series of Only Murders in the Building with... Yep. Steve Martin and Martin Short, and Nathan Lane's got a relatively small role in that, but he just lights up the screen, as they say.
He is quite a talent. I mean, I wish I'd seen him when A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, which I would really have liked to.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about Alexis Sales stuff, and I remember being very struck by many things, but particularly Angus Deighton. I just thought he's so much like John Cleese.
Yes.
It was, and I'd never seen or heard of Angus Deighton up to that point. To this day, I cannot hear the name Leslie Crowther without thinking of him in a very ill-fitting tight suit with a bald wig on playing Alexis Sale.
So what happened was we'd met Alexi making Worst Apocalypse, and when we were making the movie in Miami, I think we'd been sort of sitting around together waiting for filming and found we all got on really well. And indeed, even to this day, Alexi is one of my best friends ever, I think. You know, he's mm-hmm. he's a lovely man, not at all like the shouty sort of Alexi you see on screen. A very thoughtful. Actually, I think the recent imaginary sandwich shop episodes are actually much more interesting in a way. He's a little bit more reposed in those, isn't he? Which I think is quite interesting. And we were. I think we had lunch with Jim Moyer, who was the BBC's head of Variety. At that moment, the BBC comedy was divided into two sections: situation comedy and variety. And Jim said, "Is there anybody you'd like to make a show with?" And we said, "Alexis Sale." And because it was variety rather than comedy, situation comedy, it had to have a song in it. That was the only requisite we had. So that's why there are songs. And that's why I imagine that's why there are songs in The Young Ones as well. I think that was probably made.
Yeah, because it was then part of the light entertainment budget rather than the comedy budget, I think.
But we had enormous fun with those songs anyway. So that's how that came about. And we would go to Alexi's house, I think, once a week, and Linda would make us a lovely meal, and we'd just sit there and laugh and laugh and read things out to each other. And we had a fantastic, I think it's probably the best time I've ever had on a show making stuff. We really enjoyed that.
Like you say, you had Angus Deighton, you had fledgling comedians or comic actors like Mark Williams and Arabella Weir.
Yeah.
It turns up. Jan Ravens.
Felicity Montague and Jan Ravens.
Yeah.
Who are both brilliant in their own way, I think.
There's the absolutely wonderful sketch, the teenage girls who have
obsessed with Lord Hailsham, yes.
Lord Hailsham always comes up on this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to pick a favourite Alexis Sale sketch. I think around that time, Mark and I were taking self-defence classes, and I think self-defense via sarcasm would probably come into it. That's one of my favourite sketches.
Guide Dogs for the Dead.
Guide Dogs for the Dead, yes, that's very funny. Just visually very funny as well.
Yeah.
Cool. It's murder, this comedy writing game, isn't it, eh? You see, the trouble is that according to the experts, there's only 7 jokes in the world. That's one of them. The other 6 are about jelly.
It's very funny.
That's the most hilarious thing I've ever read in my life.
It's unbelievably funny.
What were your... I mean, how do I put this? Who did what in terms of your personal individual style and individual comedy tics? What did each of you bring to a project, if you like?
Well, Alan Boyd once said of us, and I thought this was quite accurate, that I was mischievous, whereas David was merciless. And I think that's really quite interesting. And I think when you put them together, you get quite an incendiary sort of... What we would do is, in those days, we would have very, very detailed discussions about ideas, share them out between us, go off and write a draft, and then sort of swap them over. And David would pretty ruthlessly edit everything and put it all together and assemble it, which he was very good at. This is, I learned to do that later when I was doing things by myself. So when I came to write with Rob Grant later on, it was quite, who wanted to write, you know, live together, although we do it on Zoom. It was quite a new experience for me. So that was really quite good because I'd never done that before. So I've done it both ways. and they're both equally good. David used to say that I was ideas and he was organization. And I think that's probably how it worked in our earlier days. But of course, as time wore on, he got better at ideas and I got better at organization. And we sort of became kind of equal, I think, by the time we got to Alexei Sale.
Mm-hmm. I know what I meant to ask you as well. Sorry, going backwards and forwards here. Apologies.
Sure.
Douglas Adams.
Yes.
And I know that you are supposedly the inspiration for Marvin the Paranoid Android.
Mm-hmm.
And originally it was going to be called Marshall. Is that right?
Yes, I believe so.
So can you tell, because I don't really know about your relationship with him.
We were just friends. We met up at probably around just before Birkus Way, hanging around, you know, the BBC radio places. I found him a fascinating guy. I remember Douglas and I once stayed up an entire night just talking to each other. He was a fascinating and interesting man. People often ask me about this, and I really can't help you with it because I don't know. You know, it only means something to Douglas. It doesn't mean anything to me at all. I don't know. You know, perhaps he met me in a morose mood one day. I don't think I'm generally that morose. My sort of recollection of Douglas was he was the one who was tended to be morose, and I was usually trying to cheer him up. But that just is my recollection.
Okay.
I don't know what I make of it. I do remember being in the captain's cabin, which you probably know is a pub, or was, I don't know if it's still there, round the corner from the Paris studios where we used to record everything.
Mm.
And I remember him showing me the script of the first episode of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And I remember I actually said this. I'm not making this up or changing history. I said, I think you should prepare to be famous. That was what I said after I'd read it. But looking back on it, I suspect he might have been showing me the script to see if I recognized myself in this character, which, of course, I didn't. And then he went around saying it was all based on... I could probably actually sue the Douglas Adams estate for enormous amounts of money if I wanted to, if I were an American. But I guess it's a kind of compliment, isn't it? I don't really know, to be sort of immortalized.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think it's a funny character. It's basically Eel, though, isn't it, really? It's just Eel.
Maybe it's just your way of speaking, because you've got a very measured way of speaking. Maybe it's just that. I don't know.
Who knows? I'm afraid the guy who can tell us can no longer tell us.
No, it's indeed us. Not. Okay, and so what was the reason that you and David decided to go your separate ways then?
We never did decide that, really. We were just, you know, we always did some separate things. And I, somehow or other, I was trying to develop this thing at Central Television. And I'll tell you why I did it as well. One day when we were a writing pair, David had a terrible accident on the M1, and he wasn't badly hurt, as it happens. But it made me think, oh, my God, I wonder if I could conceivably survive if David wasn't there anymore. So I was, you know, I thought I'd better just see whether it's possible for me to do it. And so I developed this not really very good sitcom, which Barry Tooker very kindly sort of encouraged me to do at Central, called Sob Sisters. Don't go and look it up. It's just dreadful. Okay. But I was learning at the time. And I kind of proved to myself I could do it. And then while I was doing that, I think David developed One Foot in the Grave, and this series I wrote didn't go down particularly well, because it just, you know, it was my very first try at something by myself, so, you know, it was a very much a nursery slope.
Yeah.
And then David was busy doing that at the BBC, so I thought, well, I better try and do something else by myself. And so I developed Two Boat Four Children, and that, and then they both those series just ran and ran and ran, and that was it. There was never any decision or falling out or anything of that kind. It just didn't, you know, that's just how it worked out.
Yeah. 2.4 Children, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I get the feeling from what I've read, from what I've learned, that it was treated pretty shabbily by the BBC.
I mean, it depends what you mean by treated shabbily. Every year they'd ask for another series and they never told us what to do. You know, we were just allowed to go on and put whatever we wanted into it. So I think in, you know, in that respect, they treated us quite well.
Wasn't there like a party or something? I'm sure I read or heard somewhere that there was a...
Yeah, I think there was... I think towards the end of the run, there was a Britain's Best Sitcom party or some such. And Gary got terribly upset because none of us were invited. But I sort of got used to them that by you know, it's one of those things that only the public like. And you know, it's true. We never won awards or anything because I don't think anyone who made the awards or who was a proper critic ever really watched it. They just saw the name, saw the, you know, a trailer and thought, oh, I know what that is. It's like Terry and June or something, and just paid no attention to it. And while they were paying no attention to it, we had the most enormous fun doing all sorts of subversive things with it. No one really noticed in the establishment. So it was, you know, a great sort of thing to do, really.
All right, I admit it.
Admit what?
Oh, I've been using the phone line at night. Ripper's my net handle.
Oh, yeah. What?
It's my email name.
What's he talking about?
Electronic mail. I've connected my computer to the internet.
You've connected your computer to the internet? Our son has connected his computer to the internet.
Internet.
We've no business doing that.
You don't know what it is,
do you? I don't care what it is. You're not to connect to any nets, even if they have got an handle. It's too expensive.
Yes, Dad.
What is it?
It's a communications network linking together millions of computers through the phone lines.
Is it?
Well, where are these computers?
Oh, everywhere in the entire world. You can link up to universities, discussion groups, US Naval Research.
US Naval Research?
NATO.
NATO?
The White House.
The White House? Oh, my God!
It's all right. It's quite legal. And you can get on cheap rate after 7 o'clock.
We should be thankful he hasn't gotten through to the FBI.
I have. They sent me a Christmas message too.
The FBI have got our address.
Oh, no, they haven't. They just know that we're on the end of a phone line.
Go and unplug it now.
That doesn't...
Quickly!
Oh, yes, Mum.
How many more of these have you got?
Oh, only 100 so far.
Well, we're getting Christmas cards from nerds we don't even know.
Oh, Ben, you don't think they'll be able to trace us here, do you?
Trace a phone line? The FBI?
No.
Who's that?
I gather you're a big, you must be a big movie buff, because there'd be very, in some cases subtle or not subtle, sort of almost like movie parodies or parodying movie and television cliches or tropes and things
when
like
you're
that.
When you're writing something for 10 years, you have to, I mean, I think there's a famous anecdote, isn't there, that Steve Martin was, I think, making LA Story and was practicing his roller skating and passed Johnny Carson. Somewhere or other, and Carson said, you'll use everything you ever knew. And I think when you're writing a sitcom, you know, 67, you'll use everything you ever knew. It's quite demanding. It doesn't sound, you know, 8 episodes a year doesn't sound awfully demanding, but it's a hell of a lot of work, I can tell you, for one person. And you know, any different way you can get into a different kind of story or a different angle you can put on something, you know, is something you need to use.
And how controlling were you? Because again, I know on One Foot in the Grave, David was always there and he was always quite adamant about this, that, and the other. Were you always present, or did you kind of let them get on with it?
I was always present for exterior filming. And on first rehearsal day, I'd probably leave them to learn the lines for a couple of days, and I'd go back a midweek, see how it was going on. Sometimes lines weren't going well, and there's usually only two reasons for that. Either the line is wrong, in which case you take it out, or the actor doesn't understand the line. And so you've got to work out which of those two it is. That sounds easy, but sometimes that can be very difficult. Is the line wrong, or do they just not understand, or is it not clear, or how do you make it clear, or something isn't working, or, you know, so I'd be around to help and to keep an eye on, you know, I mean, you know, they the actors didn't deviate from the scripts. You know, they wouldn't put in extra lines or anything like that. They were, you know, they were actors. That's what they did. They come in, they learn the script, and then they do it. That's not quite the same as me bearing down on them and saying, you've got to say it exactly this way. Gary was particularly good at finding unusual ways of saying lines, or a different sort of having a slightly odd take on things, which was always very interesting.
Gary was a marvellous actor, obviously taken far too young.
Yes.
And I know he headed up the cast and health and efficiency as well. Now, I must admit, hold my hand up, I've never seen Health and Efficiency.
Yeah, you can find it quite easily on YouTube, I think. It was enormous fun. It was kind of my version of Cheers crossed with a hospital drama, and it worked very well. The problem we had with Health and Efficiency, which is something another lesson learned, was that our designer, David Buckingham, built this enormously elaborate studio hospital set with corridors and rooms and all sorts of things. It was very labyrinthine.
Yeah.
And it was so complicated that we'd come in, because you I don't know what you know about TV recordings, but you've just got the one day in the studio to do
anything.
So we'd come in the morning and the set wouldn't be finished. In older days at the BBC, they had what was called a night crew, and they put up things during the night. But that had stopped quite recently when we made Health and Efficiency. So they would start putting it up, you know, relatively early in the day whenever the scene builders came on. And it was never quite finished in time for rehearsals. So we quite often had to record the show without having rehearsed it on the set. Obviously, we rehearsed it in the rehearsal room, in the church hall, wherever it was. But we hadn't rehearsed it on the set, which is a very different prospect. So it was really nail-biting that we would even get the show recorded, you know, in the day. And so it was quite a difficult show to make in that respect. But there's a lot about it that's very good. My partner thinks it's the best of my shows. I prefer Dad myself. But it's well worth seeing if you haven't seen it. There's some very funny episodes, some very, very funny.
I will see. Do you know, I know why I won't have watched it at the time. It's nothing to do with you. How do I put this? There's three performers, if you like, or actors or artists who I have a real problem with. One is Robert Morley. I can't watch Robert Morley. One is Lulu. Okay. And one is Roger Lloyd Pack.
Right.
And I gather Roger, and that's why I have trouble watching Only Fools and Horses as well. But he was in Health and Efficiency, wasn't he?
Yes, he played the sort of the equivalent of the sort of villain. There's two villains in Health and Efficiency. Roger Lloyd Pack's villain, who is the villain with no redeeming qualities, and and his sort of girlfriend, who's a kind of Thatcher-like figure. And she's the villain with redeeming qualities. But, he plays a kind of Danny DeVito sort of very rude surgeon. We all have people we don't like watching for some reason or other. It's some chemical personality.
I'm just weird.
You know, there's one of David's series that I can't watch because I don't like the principal actor in it. I won't name them again, but... You know, we all have these sort of blind spots about people.
Did he bite a tramp's ear, by any chance?
I don't know what that means, so...
Okay, don't worry. Gary Olsen there. And like, Two Before Children, he's marvellous. And you just think he could have gone on to so much. He could have been a much bigger star.
Yes, it was an enormous surprise. And it was a terrible business because... we knew Gary told Belinda and I and the BBC that he had pancreatic cancer. And, you know, very sadly, you look it up and the recovery rate is minuscule. It's like 0.0001% of people or something. Yeah. So we knew it was a very bad diagnosis. And Gary didn't want us to tell anyone else because he was worried that if he came back to acting, he'd never get insurance, so he wouldn't, you know, be able to, you know, if he did recover.
Yeah.
And so we had to sort of spend a year with people saying, oh, when, you know, people would say, when's the series coming back? We say, oh, well, we're not sure, and, you know, and it was quite difficult because we weren't allowed to actually say anything. So it was, and in fact, I don't think Claire and John, who played the children, knew at the time. I think all the first they knew was when his death was announced, which was very traumatic for them. I didn't realise they didn't know. I assumed the BBC would have told them, but apparently not.
Yeah.
And in fact, Geoffrey Perkins, who was head of comedy at the time, did say to me, "Do you think you could write Gary's illness into the show somehow?" And I thought about this. And I went, no, I don't think I can. I don't think that's going to work, really. And so that's when they said, okay, we'll start my family up.
Oh, right, I see. Okay. What did you find working or writing for children? And I know that by the end they were teenagers, but writing for kids notoriously can be tricky. Did you find that?
Not really, no. I thought they were... But every year I would look at John and Claire and think, how old do they look? And then that's the age they were that year. So you'll find that there's something like 5 years between them at the beginning of the series. I think there's like 1 year between them at the end of the final series. And they've aged about 5 years in 10 years or something. But of course, you have to remember that the series weren't necessarily a year apart in series time, you know. It was a sort of like a continuous run, really, of time in a way. So
yeah.
It's the same thing Agatha Christie did with Poirot. I think she worked out that Poirot would have been like 130 or something by the time he got to the last book. I think she had a rule. He only aged 2/3 of what everybody else aged or some such thing. But, you know, no one really notices as long as it doesn't look ridiculous, you know.
I think Homer Simpson in 89 when they began was 38.
Yeah.
And I think he's now after what? 30, what are we now? 89, so what was that? 34 years later, I think he's now 42.
Yeah, well, that'll be...
Yeah,
but all those things could have happened daily, couldn't they? They don't have to be weekly, you know, or even, you know, they could, the next adventure could start immediately in time after the previous one. It's all just pretend. I hate to, you know, to break this to people, but it's just a movie, as Hitchcock used to say.
shouldn't be overanalyzed, which is
to take it that seriously.
Yeah, I know. You mentioned Poirot. You did some adaptations, didn't you, of Poirot?
Yes, both David and I did two or three episodes of Poirot. I love doing that. I'm a great Agatha Christie fan.
I am too. I love. I think the best Poirot is. I think it's generally considered to be the Murder of Roger Ackroyd, which.
Yeah.
Must be the devil's own job to adapt that.
Yes.
Because of the I'm not going to spoil it, but the nature of it, you know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes. And in fact, Brian Eastman, the producer, said he had terrible trouble. And now I've got to be very careful what I say about these things in order to avoid the spoilers. But in one of the episodes I wrote, we had Poirot narrating it. And I remember Brian said to me, why is Poirot, how do we accept Poirot is narrating this? I said, because it's his show. I mean, no one's going to think that's strange at all. And when they came to make Roger Ackroyd, he remembered this narration device. And so it's Poirot who is reading a diary, which has a great significance on what later happens. I won't say any more than that.
Okay. And I know you've you have collaborated a little bit with the great John Lloyd.
Yes.
Hordes of the Things on Radio 4.
Yes, we did that. Was it during Burkus or before Burkus? I can't remember now exactly when it was. But that was fun, yes.
Am I right in saying John Lloyd was the Burkus Way producer?
He was one of our three producers. Yes, okay. They were Simon Brett, John Lloyd, and later David Hatch. I've known John since he came to the BBC as a trainee producer, and you know, throughout his life, on and off, you know, periodically we catch up. And he's an enormously clever man who you know, really has the spirit of comedy in him. I wish he was doing more things, really, but
he still props up on Radio 4 during the Museum of Curiosity,
yes.
Doesn't he?
Yes, he does. Yes, he's never. I mean, I think I'm right in saying we asked John whether he wanted to be one of the performers on Part One, and I think he turned that down. I mean, I think we periodically, David and I, tried to lure John into being a performer, but
yeah.
he always, probably very wisely, turned it down because probably he needs to do stuff in a particular genre that suits him. But yeah,
okay. There's something I want to ask you about as well. You've probably never been asked this in 30 years.
Ooh.
But it's something I'm very fond of, and it was pretty, I think it was fairly unfairly slated at the time, but the film Wilt.
Oh, yeah.
With Griff and Mel.
Yes.
Which is obviously based on the Tom Sharp novel, which you and David adapted.
Yes. Well,
I love that film.
My name is Henry Wilt, and I have a confession to make.
Henry Wilt has a confession to make concerning his wife.
A murder. It's the only logical solution. Something grisly would be good.
That's him! That's the man I saw on Friday night. He was stabbing a woman to death.
That's what we call a positive identification, Mr. Wilt.
Now, he's helping the police with their inquiries.
Make a break for it, Wilt, hey!
And his slender alibi is about to bounce. Which is not surprising, because she's made of rubber.
I see you've met her.
It's not quite as simple as that. We were brought in at the last moment by Brian Eastman. Dick and Ian had originally written the adaptation.
Oh, right. Okay.
And it was thought to not be quite right. And David and I did quite a large overhaul on it. Although there are, you know, elements of... I think Dick and Ian had done a fantastic job filleting the story and you know, setting it out in the right order and things. But... I don't remember exactly why their draft was not thought to be right, but David and I came on board and we were literally, you know, it's literally writing what you scenes and handing them, you know, under the door to the director almost. We did a job. I think we did quite a major overhaul in it, but I don't want to in any way minimize the work Dick and Ian had done on it, because they had done a lot of spade work in the original draft.
Well, those guys, I mean, God, they're in Hollywood now, aren't they, still?
I think they were in Hollywood then.
Script doctors on things like The Rock.
Yeah.
Films like The Rock. Amazing career those two guys have had. But
absolutely, they're absolute masters of comedy.
But I interviewed Griff Rhys-Jones a few months ago. And I tried to get him to talk about Wilt, and he didn't want to. He kept changing the subject. So was it an unhappy? I mean, I know you were just sort of involved with the script writing, but were you on set at all? Did you see any of it?
I think we went to a filming occasionally. I didn't get the impression it was that much. I think it did well enough to make its money back. I've never had the impression it was a real failure of any kind. I thought it worked quite well, as far as I can remember. So who knows? I don't really know. The trouble with Tom Sharp is he is unadaptable, really. You can't really put that quality into a movie. A book is a book, and a movie is a movie. And they're very different things. You can try, you can try and do, you know, certain things. But, you know, getting the essence of it into movie form is a difficult thing. So it's probably, if there were criticisms of it at the time, it was probably from Tom Sharp literary fans who probably were disappointed it didn't quite have the qualities that the books have. But to be honest, you can't do that. It's just not really possible. It never, you know, Tom Sharp books live in a world of their own universe. You can't really, when you start to bring that universe into reality, you know, which is more a movie, you can't really, you know, you can't really replicate that. You can do your best. You can make a kind of, what was it? What's the expression? Palimpsest of it, but you can't actually replicate it accurately.
I've never seen Porterhouse Blue, but I gather that was quite acclaimed as a as an adaptation.
Yeah, Brian also did Porterhouse Blue and Blot on the Landscape. Yeah, I think that was probably an easier one to do, though. I think it's probably less less fantastic.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got, with Wilt, you've got, you know, a man and a blow-up doll. And
yes.
The bizarre circumstances, which is fine written down. You could write it down. There's all sorts of things you could write down. You know, you could write down he suddenly realises he's in Cairo or something, but it doesn't mean to say you can put it on screen, because how does that happen? You know, you can write down someone mistakes a horse for Esther Ranson or something, but you wouldn't do that in real life because they're obviously very different.
Absolutely. Totally different.
That's probably a terrible thing to say. I probably shouldn't.
She doesn't listen.
Can I just say, that was not a reference to Esther Ranson's teeth. I was trying to find two things in my head that were very dissimilar, and they just were the things that came into my head. So,
okay.
Sorry, Esther, I didn't mean it like you think.
I'd like to get Esther on the show, though, by the way, because she used to go to Goon Show recordings back in the 50s.
Hmm. Yeah. I know, I'm an enormous fan of Esther. I wouldn't say anything against Esther Ranson, even though I just did.
Yeah, okay. So, look, better wrap up. You've been working in recent years with the, like you mentioned before, with Rob Grant. So are you collaborating on anything at the moment?
Well, we are. We're collaborating on several things. We might do a new book. We might do a new TV series. We might do a new radio series. We sort of came to the end of our radio series, as is very often the case when the controller of Radio 4 changed over, and you tend to find, and this is kind of the bane of my life, you just sort of get a nice run of something and then the controller changes, so, and they like something, they're a completely different character, they like totally different things than they do. You have to stop that and regroup. So we're in a sort of regrouping situation at the moment. There's something about the desire to make comedy, the drive to do it, that never really dies. And okay, you know, you might get to the point where they don't let you make it anymore, but it never stops you wanting to make it. You never stop wanting to get that laugh to delight those people. It's something that's just born in you. I don't know what it is. It's a bit of a curse, and it's a bit of a pleasure. But I hope to go on making comedy in some form or other as long as I possibly can. So bad luck, everyone.
You probably get asked this all the time. You know what I'm going to ask you. Would the two of you work again, do you think?
David and I?
Mm.
I don't think so, no. I think, you know, over the years, we've sort of slightly diverged in our paths, and I shouldn't imagine we would fit together very well now.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean to say we're not still great friends. You know, contact each other from time to time, and you know, I'm you know, I will always be a great admirer of David's work and David's work ethic, which, you know, is an extraordinary thing. People often wonder why David is so successful. Well, the answer is very simple: he works very, very hard.
Mm. Yeah. Last question, actually, just occurred to me. When you kind of went your separate ways, as it were, you know, you had 2.4 children, health and efficiency, he had one foot. Did either of you ever offer the other sort of advice on your solo projects, if you know what I mean? Did either of you, you know, did he ever pick up the phone to you and say, oh, you know, I think you should be doing this.
I think it was the opposite, really. I think we declined to offer each other any opinions for fear of upsetting the other person. You know, I think you've got I think they're just kind of mutual respect there. But I don't, you know, I don't, it's not for me to say, you know, what David should be doing or vice versa, really, because he knows perfectly well what his aims are, and he's done extraordinarily well out of it, and good for him. I mean, yeah. He's an extraordinary talent. I wouldn't say anything else.
Oh, well, that's Andrew. I want to, you know, thank you for your time today, and thank you for giving me so many laughs over the years as well. And I hope that this hasn't been too much of an ordeal for you. This hour and a half.
Pleasant enough chat. And, just edit out the libelous bits later, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah.
anything that will get me cancelled.
Okay, I will do.
Probably pretty much all of it.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.